Proverbs. This works. Proverbs chapter 27. We may try one more time so you guys can cross your fingers with this. What?
He didn't shower this morning.
I don't shower any morning. For residency?
What? You don't do that? I gotta do that.
No. No. Man, you guys are lucky if I brush my teeth. That's why I sit up here. No, I brush my teeth every morning. Exactly. People are like, front row, hey, we rearranged. Halitosis. 27:18. Somebody read that. 27:18, Proverbs, that book after Psalms that we go to every morning when I'm here. 27:18, Proverbs, with me. Nope.
Whoever tends a fig tree will eat its fruit, and he who guards his master will be honored.
All right, so he who tends a fig tree will eat its fruit. Is that right? You work a fig tree, you provide for it, you water it, you fertilize it, you tend it, you take care of it. What's the end result? You get fruit, right? You get to bear the enjoy the bounty that that fig tree will provide, okay? He who cares for his master, is what my version says, will be honored. A little bit different nuance than the first part. There's obviously a similarity here, okay? When you care for another, you get to enjoy the fruit of you working for another, i.e. a fig tree. What happens when a person is a servant and takes care of his master? He doesn't meet just his own needs, but cares for his master's needs. What does the psalm or the proverb say here? You're honored, right? You're going to enjoy the fruit of, just like you would with a fig tree, working for your master and making them great and exalting them and your time and attention being on them and not on you, okay? This is a proverb about being a great number two, okay? This is the idea of every one of you in life and in positions are always going to be somewhere where there's somebody above you, a boss, a board, you're going to be a subordinate to somebody, right? And that's the reality that we're all going to live in. Even those that are CEOs and what have you, they still have to be accountable to other people, okay? And I don't know anyone that lives in a world where they have complete autonomy and freedom and can do whatever they want to and nobody can ultimately fire them, okay? And when they think they do, they find out they don't pretty quickly, okay? What's the concept here? What does that mean? As followers of Christ and as believers, what should our mentality be if we're going to be in a position where we're always a number two to somebody else? What does that mean? How do we apply this?
It's a great great opportunity to show physically how you are spiritually to God.
Absolutely. Okay, so what does that look like as an employee? How do you do that? Yeah, with humility. What's your goal at the end of the day as an employee then? To make your boss look great. Okay, now that's not always the case, but I think if we went into work with that mentality, whether you work for some rip-roaring pagan or, you know, a great Christian boss, regardless of the spectrum that you may live on, to say, listen, I am here to make you look great and to accomplish what it is you have hired me to do, and I'm here to serve you. I'm here to lift up your name, not to bring the spotlight onto me, but to accomplish that, okay? People with that mentality, you think they stick around for a while? Hey, I'm here to serve. What do you need me to do? Do I need to scrub toilets today? Great. Do I need to teach a lesson? Great. Do I need to do fun work or menial work? It doesn't matter. What needs to get done around this organization to make sure that you get exalted? You think you're going to get a raise? You think you like, you know, employers like that type of person? Those people with that type of team mentality that are willing to say, look, whatever's best for the team, whatever's best for my boss, those people are difficult to find. And when you find them, you keep them and you do whatever it takes to retain them on your team, okay? Now, I realize some of you have bosses that are much different than the type of bosses that I have, okay? I happen to have Rick's my boss, so Rick's fantastic, right? And before that, it was Brad and Tim, and I've had a number. But I happen to have Christians above me that I love and respect and know and can work for with delight. Okay, there are others of you that work in industries that you're like, dude, if I could shoot my boss, that would be the best part of my day, right? Terry, some people probably say that about you at work, right? T, baptism. They didn't say that. They probably love you, right? But all of us have been in those situations where you're like, oh gosh, I want to strangle my boss. How can I even imagine serving them and working for them with that attitude of humility? And regardless, okay, that's what Scripture calls us to. Can you guys think of biblical examples of people that put themselves in that type of situation, regardless of the type of boss that they had, and they were so quickly recognized for their gifts and their talents that that boss said, man, I cannot afford not to have them. Whatever it takes, they're on my team. Daniel, absolutely, right? What was his boss like? Pagan king, didn't even share his beliefs. Daniel didn't believe a lick of what he believed. But he said, man, that guy's amazing. I have to keep him around. Who else?
Nehemiah.
Nehemiah is a classic example, right? His position as a cupbearer to a king was one that was, you had to trust the guy that was bringing you your food because that was one of the easiest ways to kill a king, right? So he somehow had worked himself into a position where he was a very trusted outsider to a pagan king, right? And if you know anything about King Artaxerxes, he's a nut job. So for him to have that relationship with Nehemiah was something, okay? Who else?
Joseph.
How about Joseph, who we're going to study in a bit? Amazing guy who came into Pharaoh's house and said, you're going to see some stuff out of Joseph. You're like, really? Like in terms of, I'm going to make Pharaoh silly, filthy rich. That was his perspective, because I can. I'm a great administrator. I know my talents, and I'm going to make you filthy rich. The world is going to come to you for food. That's because of Joseph, okay? So note to self, if you have that quality about you, you will never have problems finding work, okay? Now, a part of that job all the time is doing stuff that you may not particularly love to do, okay? 20% of every job is scrubbing toilets. No one likes it, okay? It has to be done. But if you maintain that mentality in your job, you will not have a problem finding work, and you will not have a problem getting retained at what you do and exalted up that ladder, okay? So tend the fig tree of your master and see what happens and see if God does not honor you, okay? Thoughts? All right, back to Genesis. Stephanie, will you pray for us this morning as we jump back into maybe finish the life of Abraham this morning? Amen. That works. That works. All right. So, where were we? 19. We finished, right? Dark, depressing. We're out of Sodom. Thank God. This is one of those chapters you want to like hurry up and finish so you don't have to revisit it the next day. Like, oh, doom and gloom. It's all going to die. Okay. So, we do need to remind ourselves where we were. Okay. We left Lot with his two daughters in a cave, hung over with not one, but two pretty big oopses, okay? Two incestuous relationships with his daughters that now have what two people groups are going to come from them?
The Ammonites
and the Moabites, okay? They're going to live east. I would show you, but I can't because our thing doesn't work. We'll try one more time. Push the right button, Mikey. So we'll see if this comes back. They live east of the Jordan River, okay? So the Moabites are going to live just to the east of the Dead Sea, kind of in that area, and the Ammonites are going to live east but further north, okay? So that's the idea. What does mean? I can't see anything behind me. Let's try. By the way, you're going to see a theme. I think, did we read it yesterday where it says that Ishmael lived in defiance of his brothers? Maybe it's today. I get my days confused as to what I've read and what I've taught. East often has the connotation of disobedience. So, like, they got kicked out of the garden. They lived east of Eden, okay? The old James Dean film, that was the context of that. East of Eden was the idea of defiance. So you'll see oftentimes, not always, but when you see that mentioned, it's a clue to go, huh, they're living east of where they're supposed to be. That's often, it oftentimes means they're in defiance of what God wanted them to do, okay? Make sense? All right, let's see if we can. Do we have anything?
Yay!
Wow, we're friends again. Okay, will you kill one of those light switches? Don't panic. All right, you sillies. All right, So here is, you can't see to the bottom, okay? Right there. That's Moab, okay? So Moab's down here. Dead Sea, you guys remember all this? All our coastal plains, Shephelah, hill country, wilderness. Okay, these extend a little bit further up here. Moabites live down here. Here are the Ammonites. They will live over here. Okay, so just so you guys are kind of in a picture, and we'll see a couple more today that will make sense as well. Okay, things that will be importante. Okay, I'll jump out of there so we're not staring at a map all day. All right, so that's where they end up. All right, so 19, that's what where we have left Lot, and now we're going to return back to the story of Abraham. Okay, so let's walk through, if we can, maybe from memory, because I don't have my chart in front of me, so we're going to have to do it from memory. We're about to see his seventh test this morning, okay? Seven, and then we'll see, he's got one more coming, okay? So let's just walk through, guys, if you can. What was test one? What did we see? What was the call on Abraham's life? To go, right? To leave the promised land, his promised land, to go to the promised land, I suppose. To leave Ur of the Chaldees and come into the land, okay? What was the second test?
Famine
in the land, right? Goes to Egypt, pass or fail?
Fails
that one, okay? So he's one for two so far, batting 50% or 500, okay? What was the next test after that? Comes back in Egypt, he's got strife with?
Hidden Lot,
right?
In the land
was the issue, okay? So how did he do on that one? Fast, right? Lot, you go first. You choose what you want. God, you choose for me. God walks him through the land, okay? Chapter 14, we meet a guy by the name of Melchizedek. It's like Mephibosheth, Methuselah. Nope. Going through the Rolodex. Okay. Melchizedek, okay? What was the test there in the midst of all that deal? Wins that battle, meets two kings, the king of Jerusalem, and then he meets the pagan king of Sodom. What was the test in the midst of that?
Honor to himself or to God?
Yeah, are you going to give honor to this pagan king so that people would say, hey, he has made you the person that you are, the king of Sodom, or are you going to give tribute to Melchizedek and honor him and give him as opposed to taking, okay? So it was an odd test, but he doesn't sell out, okay? So he says, nope, God's going to be the one that I honor, okay? So however you want to title that one, I put sell out in my Bible, and he doesn't, okay? After that, chapter 15, we find out Abraham's thinking again about an heir, okay? How does he do with that? After that immediate deal, God comes back and says, hey, I am your protection, I am your shield. You see an initial response from God of, hey, he kind of passes that test in a sense, but then what does he do immediately after that? Who does he have?
Ishmael,
okay? So test 5 and 6 kind of go together. You probably ought to just make it 1. So this idea of an heir, how does he ultimately do? He fails, right? He goes into Hagar, listens to his wife. We said that's the problem. Husbands, don't listen to your wives. Remember, that was our good theology from that day. Just making sure you're awake, okay? So he fails that test, right? Okay, and now we're going to see test 7, okay? Interesting. God's going to take Abraham back to test 2 and say, hey, I'm going to give you your redo. So test 7 is test 2, take 2. Okay, so we'll see how he does. Okay, chapter 20, verse 1. Let's pick up there and let's see where we're at in our story. Out loud.
From there, Abraham journeyed toward the territory of Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur.
All right, talk to me. Where's the Negev? You guys remember? What's going on here?
It is
up there on our map. I suppose that you're right. Normally we would say down there, right? Because it's down, okay? Here's the Negev, right? Dead Sea's right here. Mediterranean's over here. Okay, so we're south in the land, okay? Here is Beersheba, or Beersheba, however it's written. Okay, maps vary. Okay, the B's and V's often get interchanged, okay? So this is the Negev. So that's where he's at. And it says he is where? Kadesh and Shur, okay? These are, where are you? Here's Gerar. Kadesh Barnea is down south. Kadesh is, where did you go, you booger? Here it is. This is Kadesh over here. Okay, Kadesh Barnea, where the spies go into the land. You guys remember that story? They spy out the land. This is where they're going to go. Okay, they're going to come from down south to get there, okay? And Gerar is going to be in the Gaza kind of area, kind of in the coastal plain, okay? It's right here, Okay, is that mentioned here? Yes, he sojourned in Gerar, okay? Okay, if Gerar is a city in the coastal plain, who should we expect lives there? Philistines, good, okay? So keep that in mind as we read our story, okay? Keep going, verse 2.
And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister.
What? So he goes into a land with a pagan king, Philistine king, and he says what? All right, we're not rereading the same story, okay? It's like, dude, did you not learn anything the first time this happened? It did not bode well for you. Last time you said, hey, Sarah, why don't you say you're my sister wife, right? Never good, okay? So he does the same thing. So he's going to fail the same test now twice, and we'll see how this ends up, okay? So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Sound familiar? Okay, so she's still at 90 years old. Unbelievable. Okay, so Abraham picked a woman way out of his league. So she's spiritual and she apparently is good looking. Okay, so verse 3, keep it going.
But God came to
Abimelech. Abimelech, by the way, is a title. It's like Pharaoh. It's not the same person. We're going to see Isaac interact with a guy named Abimelech. Okay, same person. It's like Mr. President. It's like, what are you talking about? Bush or Clinton or Obama or who are you talking about? Okay, that's the idea. Okay, it's just a title. Okay, so he's interacting with Abimelech, and what happens?
In a dream by night, and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife."
Wow. So you get this Philistine king that God shows up to in a vision and says, "You're a dead man because you have taken this man's wife." Okay. Now, how's Abimelech feeling at this point? Hey, whoa, you got your, I'm talking on the wrong guy. Look, this was sister, I took her, I'm not a follower of you, okay? So this had to be an odd interaction for him all the way around. He's hearing from a god he does not worship. They worship Dagon, which is a fish god, really funny. We'll study him later, okay? Half fish, half man, okay? So more on Dagon later, but that was their primary deity. They had a house for Dagon, and interesting god, but definitely not a follower of Yahweh, okay? So Abimelech, now in verse 4 says, had not come near her, for the Lord said, you will slay a nation even though blameless. So he basically says, I haven't touched her, so are you going to kill my entire nation even though, like, yes, she's in my house, but I haven't laid a hand on her, okay? So now we got a pagan king calling God to a standard, which is interesting. So he says, hey, maybe I've heard of you or I know your character. You're not going to kill everybody, are you? Did he not himself say to me, back to God, now this is Abimelech speaking to God, she is my sister, and she said herself, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this. So he's saying, dude, not guilty. Okay, God, I have done nothing wrong, okay? Which is odd, because here you again, you have the pagan who's in the spot of being blameless, and you've got Abraham who is dead wrong, right? He has lied now for the second time. He knows better. He's felt the consequences of this. So in case he wasn't sure if he was supposed to lie about Sarah being my sister and not my wife, he's pretty clear at this point, right? Somebody else pick up in verse 6.
And God said to him in the dream, yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her.
Now, someone, put on your hermeneutics lenses again. Talk to me about adultery, according to verse 6. Give me some commentary. God makes a very interesting statement here to Abimelech about adultery. Yeah, Jesus is certainly going to up the ante later. Okay, what else do you notice?
He has control. He's saying he has control of the situation.
Absolutely. Now, if you were to sleep with another man's wife, in this situation, who would that sin be against? The wife or Abraham in this case, right? What does God say? It's not a sin against Abraham. It's a sin against me. Talk to me about adultery.
It's a sin against God.
It's a sin against God, okay? Is it obviously a sin against the husband and the wife? Yes, absolutely. How does God view that? Is it bigger than that? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Why?
Because it's a marriage covenant to God.
You guys see the big deal that this is in God's eyes? Okay. I made marriage. I started marriage. Okay. I put these two together. They are one flesh. This isn't just a sin against another person. It is a sin against me. Okay. So just note the self. Okay. God's giving you some just kind of backdoor commentary on his view of marriage. Okay. It's a big deal. Okay. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet. First time we've seen this language used of Abraham. Okay. He is called a prophet. Okay. He will pray for you and you will live. Okay. Again, odd. So this guy who is in sin is going to pray for you. And as a result of that, I'm not going to kill you, Abimelech. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all you who are yours. I will take down this entire city. Okay. Now, why is this, again, such a big deal for God? Why is not just the adultery piece, but why obviously is this a big deal? If Abimelech sleeps with Sarah. Absolutely. Yeah, we don't have Isaac yet. Isaac doesn't come till chapter 21, okay? So the question could be, well, was she from Pharaoh? Was she from Abimelech? Was she from Abraham? We don't know. So God says, I'm not. This is a really, really big deal, okay? So God says, no, we're not playing that game, okay? So he says, give her back or I'll kill you and your whole city, okay? And by the way, I just did that in chapter 19. So in case you're wondering, I can and I will, okay? So Abimelech surely would have gotten word of a city that had had fire and brimstone rain down upon it. So more than likely he knew of Abraham's God. So that doesn't happen every day, right? When he read the newspaper. Huh, look at that. Okay, so now, tension's going to turn from Abimelech and God talking now to Abimelech and Abraham. Verse 9, keep reading.
Brought on me and my kingdom a great sin. You have done to me things that ought not to be done.
Boy, that just stings, doesn't it? The pagan king calling out the Christian saying, how dare you? How dare you be dishonest with me? You have brought sin into my household. You have potentially cost me my life and the life of all of my people. Abraham, what are you doing? Like, this is the second time that Abraham's been called to the carpet by a pagan, okay? So, interesting. Okay, they're going to have a kind of a come to Jesus meeting relationally in a couple chapters and see how they're going to interact. Okay, because Abraham is blown this. Okay, Abimelech said to Abraham, "What have you encountered that you have done this thing?" Okay, so he asks him, "Dude, what's going on?" Verse 11. I want you to see Abraham's explanation. Read this.
Abraham said, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place. And they will kill me because of my wife."
Okay, I want you to, okay, here's excuse one, okay, keep going.
"Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife."
Okay, so there's the family lineage somewhere. She is a half-sister, and God has allowed this for whatever reason, okay? Unpack verse 11 for me, because we've all done this, okay? What's going on with Abraham? What do you call that? Justifying the situation, okay? So because this is the deal, there's a bunch of pagans in this land, it's not going to go well for me. Okay, you can see him rationalizing in his head why this is okay, okay? What is the motivator, by the way? What motivates him to do this? Okay, keep going. Starts with an F. Fear, okay? I want you guys just to make note of this. As we walk through Scripture, whenever you see decisions that are based in fear, always, without exception, leads to bad decisions, okay? When you are motivated to make some decision based on fear of what could happen, you'll always make a bad decision, okay? What does that tell you about Abraham's view of God right now? He's still too small. He's not there yet, right? He didn't have the confidence to say, you know what? God's really big. I've seen him move in some pretty cool ways. He surely can take care of the situation. Yeah, I'm the minority. I don't know how this is going to work out, but I don't need to take the situation in my own hands and lie in order to save my backside, okay? You're going to see Saul's kingdom is defined. It turns on literally on a dime when he starts making decisions based on fear. In the end of his career, when David is around, like decision after decision he makes based on fear. It's sad. Fear and insecurity, okay? So just note to self, that's what motivates Abraham to make this decision. We all feel that. We've all done that. Fearful of what could happen, fearful of, you know, which way this is going to end up. Just when you're in those moments, just push the pause button, step outside yourself, and then tell yourself, dude, this is really stupid, okay? This is what's hard to do in those moments, but when you see that pattern, I can't think of a time I have ever made a godly decision in the midst of fear when I've tried to rationalize and justify why I should do what I'm doing, okay? So, and I'm sure you felt the same, okay? And then 12, further rationalization is, well, it's kind of true, right? My mom's old, this, it's a white lie. It's kind of a half-truth. It's not really bad, it's just kind of bad. So, and I'm not so-and-so, so at least I'm not that, so I can do this, right? So, okay? So yeah, he gives you that, okay? And verse 13, came about when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, this is the kindness which you will show me everywhere we go. Say to me, here he is my brother. What does that tell you, verse 13? This is a sidebar that he and Abimelech are having. And what has he communicated is the trend when they leave town between, what do they say when they leave town and talk to other people about his relationship with Sarah? Mm-hmm. So has this just happened twice? What does the text say? Everywhere we go. This is one of those old habits that stuck with Abraham. We saw it with Pharaoh, and I think we got the story there. We're seeing it again with Abimelech, and I would imagine there are story after story after story where it's happened in between these bookends, okay? By the way, who's going to struggle with lying just like his dad? Isaac. Where do you think he learned that? Dad. He saw it. Hey, when push comes to shove and you're not sure, this is what you have to do. Most of the time, don't do that. But in these situations, do it. This was a habit. This was a thorn in his flesh that he couldn't let go of.
I was trying to think about how Sarah feels kind of abandoned by her.
Yeah, that's got to be tough. Ladies, I mean, how would you feel in that situation as a wife? That's a nightmare, right? Lie. I don't want to lie. Well, you're gonna. Oh, okay, what do you do? Arm wrestle him? Right? What do you do? Okay, note the self. That. Can you imagine how that would play out? Right? Yeah. So it's he's put his wife in a really, really difficult situation, apparently more than once. I think we get the two pictures of when Abraham got called to the carpet. Okay. I think a lot of times he probably walked into town. That's my sister. Oh, cool. Oh, nothing happened. Next town. Oh, that's my sister. Okay. Oh, this is working, right? You guys been there? Oh, there's no consequences to my sin. I just keep doing it. Great. Okay. So scary how true it is in my life, right? And then one time, Abimelech, Pharaoh, somebody calls him to the carpet and says, dude, how dare you? How dare you not act like a Christian? So he gets called out, okay? Same story, verse 14. Abimelech then took sheep, oxen, male and female servants, gave them to Abraham, restored his wife, okay? Here's your wife back and a whole bunch of money and a whole bunch of stuff, okay? Behold, my land is before you, settle wherever you wish, okay? So wherever you want to go, as long as it's not here, please leave. To Sarah, he said, behold, I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication before all who are with you and before all men who are cleared. Okay, so he punks Sarah a little bit to Abraham, right? I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. And this was, you're going to see Abraham do this in a chapter, but he's basically saying, to prove that I am the righteous in this conversation, I am giving you money to show that my hands are clean. It seems like an odd deal. He's not bribing them. He's just saying, listen, I've done right. And to prove that, so there's never a question, I'm going to do right twofold, and I'm going to give you 1,000 pieces of silver so that there's no question as to who's in the right here. Okay, so that's kind of the idea. All right. Again, odd verse 17. Watch what God does.
And Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, and also healed his wife and female slaves, so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife.
So you wonder how long, like, they were there, where they figured out man, there ain't no kids. Like, God has shut down the womb of everyone in town. And Abimelech starts looking around and says, hey, newbie, what are you doing? Who's this girl? Oh, she's your wife. So apparently they were there long enough where this started affecting it. And God says, nope, shutting down all the wombs. No babies, okay? And again, Abraham has to pray in order for God to remove this curse because he is the prophet who's in sin in this situation, okay? So odd string of events, okay? But relationship, Abraham and Abimelech, we'll see that again, okay? So note this out, all right? Now, 21, here is what we have now spent 25 years, or in our case, 2 weeks, waiting for, okay? So 21:1, let's pick up there. Now, note to self, how long ago did that promise occur? 25 years, okay? Just, gang, remember that. God does not forget. He had promised, okay? He remembers and he does, okay? But boy, the time between God saying whatever to us in the sense of taking care of us or what have you to the delivering of that promise, he doesn't do that according to our watch. Chuck Swindoll used to say, God made time and man made watches. And we try to hold God to our timetable and it doesn't work. Okay? Verse 2, keep going.
Sarah became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age. At the very time, God had promised.
Okay, so exactly a year ago when God said, hey, these guys, when they come back, you're going to have a kid a year from now. And they did. Abraham called the name of his son. Who was born to him, was born from Sarah to him, Isaac. Okay, what does Isaac mean again? God laughs. Okay, he laughs. Okay. Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. So again, so Abraham is showing faith in this covenant and in this promise. Okay. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born. That means Sarah is 90. Okay. And Sarah says, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. What does that mean? What is she saying?
God has made her happy.
God's made her happy. Okay, what else? In a sense, it's more than that. She's 90.
People around her are going to think it's funny that God made her pregnant at 90.
Everyone's going to go, no way. No way that happened, right? And you've heard those stories where you're like, that is an absolute miracle, crazy. God showed up. It's one of these stories. And people are going to go, that's ridiculous, right? God showed up, and that's exactly how God wanted it, okay? It took him 25 years to put the circumstances in such a way where there was clearly no way that Abraham and Sarah could manipulate the situation in their favor, so they were at the end of their rope, and now God moves, and they have Isaac, okay? Abraham was 100, Sarah 90. They name him, again, Isaac, and she says in verse 7, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children. So not only does she have the privilege of having kids, but she gets to nurse her kid, okay? When I have born a son in this old age, okay? The child grows, verse 8, is weaned, and Abraham made a feast on the day Isaac was weaned, which in that culture was somewhere between 2 and 5 when they were done breastfeeding, okay? That was, they took it a little bit further in terms of age in that culture, but somewhere kind of in that realm, okay? Now we've got an issue, another issue, or the same issue that's been there now for a long time, with Sarah, Hagar, Ishmael, and now Isaac. So we've got, it's about to boil over, okay? Somebody pick up there in verse 9.
Sarah became pregnant and bore a son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had born to Abraham laughing. So she said to Abraham, cast out the slave woman with her son, for the son this slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac.
Now, what happened last time that was suggested by Sarah?
Didn't go well,
right? Kick him out, okay? And God says, uh-uh. You go back, you get them, you bring them back into town, you take care of that kid for 13 years, and then we'll talk, okay? So now there's tension because we've got Isaac and Ishmael, and they're, again, you can already see it, okay? Early on, they're fighting for Who's number one? Who's the child of the covenant? Okay, so the matter greatly distressed Abraham, verse 11. But God says to Abraham, "Do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. For through Isaac your descendants shall be named. Okay, so this time, Abraham, according to verse 14, listens to his wife, says to Isaac and Hagar, here's some stuff, here's some provisions. Love you, mean it, but on with you too. Okay, so he gives them the boot out of camp. Okay, so note to self, guys, this is interesting. Okay, you've got to walk with God enough to know when your wife is like, you know what, that is great counsel. And time enough to say, you know what, babe, I love you. But I think we need to do this, okay? I can't think of a decision that I've made that has any sort of magnitude to it that I don't ask my wife, okay? She is smarter than me. She's more spiritual than me. Guys, most of you are going to marry women that are the same, okay? Make sure when you guys are making decisions that you include your wife in those things. There's nothing more frustrating than a wife who doesn't feel heard and can't express how she feels. Women have a much easier time saying, I'm willing to follow this guy. Again, if he's following God and seeking Christ, even if it's not the decision that I would have made, if he listens to me and I feel heard and he's weighed my opinion and values it and still does something different, that's a much easier situation than, hey, honey, here's the new car that I just bought, and you roll into the driveway with, you know, a $30,000 vehicle. Like, well, did we want to talk about that on whether we should have done that, if that was a wise financial decision, what color the car was going to be, like, hello, right? And I've heard of guys doing that, like, dude. So, note to self, okay? One time, he gets rebuked for listening to his wife. The other time, God says, listen to your wife. She's got great advice, okay? So, you'll have to weigh those, okay? But make sure in the course of marriage that you listen to your bride and talk to her and pull out of her what is in her and give her the chance to respond, okay? So he now sends out Ishmael and Hagar. They departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. Where are we? Is that a member? Okay. The Negev, okay. Beersheba is, dang it, why does it keep hiding? Down to the left. No, that's Kadesh. Dang it, where did you go? I just showed you guys where it was earlier. It is. Yep. Where?
Right there.
Right there. You guys are smart. My cursor's on it. I couldn't see it. Beersheba. Okay, so they're here, right on the edge. You guys see green, and now it's getting ugly. Okay, this is the edge of the desert. Okay, let's keep reading. We're going to see some other boundary markers that are mentioned here in a bit. Okay. 15.
When the water in the skin was gone, she put the child under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot. For she said, let me not look on the death of the child.
Ooh, so this is like the same experience she had before, right? They've used all the provisions. They're in the desert. Kid's about to die. She's about to die. She sets the kid away because like she doesn't want to see this go down, okay? God shows up, verse 17. Keep going.
And God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is.
Okay, so the angel of the Lord, again, I would argue that this is the pre-incarnate Christ who's now showed up twice to Hagar. So, cool. Arise, lift your head, hold him by the hand, for I will make him a great nation. God opened her eyes. She saw a well of water. She sent and filled the skin with water and gave the lad to drink. Okay, again, water in the desert is obviously everything. Okay, so this is a miracle, right? So God shows her a well that apparently she couldn't see that was right by her. Okay, so God provides. 20, keep going.
And God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and took a wife from the land of Egypt.
Paran, okay, here's the wilderness of Paran, way down south, okay? So we are going to go in our journey here, En Avdat, okay? So we're going to go down here in the wilderness of Zin, which is where Israel wandered. They camped out and lived further south, okay, in the wilderness of Paran. Again, Egypt is right, you know, like here, okay? So they're a stone's throw away. He takes a wife from Egypt because that's what his mom provided, okay? Why would she have taken a wife from Egypt for her son? That's where she's from. That's what she knows, right? So takes a wife from Egypt, and now they're going to have all these mixed, you know, peoples and beliefs and all that, okay? So that's going to be the fallout of Ishmael, okay? So he lives in the wilderness of Paran. His mother takes a wife for him from Egypt, and we'll see how that plays out, okay? Back to Abimelech and Isaac, all right? Abraham, rather. Okay, Abimelech and Abraham. 22, pick up there. Philcol. This is an interesting request. What is Abimelech asking of Abraham?
Basically, don't lie to me again.
Yeah.
Please don't lie to me again.
Can we DTR here and have a relationship based on like honesty and truth and not lies, Abraham? Can we talk this through? God's blessing you. You're clearly multiplying. God has his hand on you. I can see that. But based on our previous interaction, and we can't work this way. We need to have a relationship based on truth and honesty. If we're going to live around each other, this isn't going to work. Again, this is the pagan calling the Christian to live to a certain moral standard. Okay, so you almost kind of like this guy, right? Like, look, dude, this isn't going to work, Abraham. So he says, look, we're not going to deal falsely with one another, with you and I or our families. We're not going to do that and those that come after us. But according to the kindness that I've shown to you, you shall show to me and to the land in which you have sojourned. So he calls him to the carpet, okay? Abraham says, verse 24, great idea, okay? Now, they've kind of committed. They've sealed the deal. They've DTR'd. They've hugged or whatever they need to do, okay? 25, there's an issue between these two, okay? Here's the issue. Okay, so what's happened? What is Abraham saying to Abimelech?
He's like calling him out about a well.
About a well. Whose well is it? Who does Abraham think it is?
Abraham thinks it's his.
He said, look, your servants stole a well from me, okay? They've seized it. Abimelech says, dude, I have no idea what you're talking about, okay? Now, again, big deal, okay? If you live in the desert and somebody steals your water, you're dead, okay? It's as easy as that. Or you've got to go find another place to go dig a well. We're going to go look at this well in Beersheba when we go to Israel. And you're going to, it's so ridiculously deep, you're going to go, dude, I wouldn't want to build that with today's modern equipment, much less, their Flintstones and however they would have dug this thing. It's ridiculous how hard it is to get water in the desert, okay? So this is not just, dude, go to the Motel 6 and turn the water on. It's not that big a deal, Abraham. It's like, no. This means death for everybody, okay? So when he begins to complain about lack of water in the desert, big deal, okay? So Abimelech says, hey, I have no idea what you're talking about, okay? Now watch what Abraham does. This is fascinating. 27.
So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two men made a covenant.
Okay.
Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock apart.
Okay, so he takes sheep and oxen. They make a covenant, okay? So you remember what Abimelech did with 1,000 pieces of silver to Sarah? Hey, I'm clean in this matter, okay? I did not sleep with your wife. Here's $1,000 to prove it, okay? Abraham says, Abimelech, you stole my well, okay? Your servant stole my well. Abimelech says, dude, we're good. I have no idea what you're talking about. Abraham says, okay, you're not lying to me. I trust you. You have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm buying back the well from you that's already mine. I own this well. But in order to prove that it is mine, I'm going to repurchase it from you so that we're all clear on whose well this is. Hence, the sheep that he starts with and oxen as a kind of a writing of their relationship. And then he sets apart 7 ewe lambs, okay? We'll find out why 7 of the flock by themselves, okay? 29, Abimelech says, hey, what do these 7 ewe lambs mean which you have set by themselves? You've already given me oxen and sheep in verse 27, and now there's an additional 7 ewe lambs in verse 28, okay? 30, here's Abraham's answer. Read that.
He said, these 7 ewe lambs you will take from my hands, that is, that this may be a witness for me that I dug this well.
Okay, so Abraham says, I dug it. This is mine. I put in the backbreaking work. It's my well, okay? What do they call the well, verse 31? Okay, well of the 7 or well of the oath. It can mean either, okay? That, again, there is Beersheba. Okay, so this well that is in this town, Abraham dug this thing. He says, it's my well. And they're saying, we've made an oath, the well of the oath, or well of the seven, i.e. the seven ewe lambs. It's a kind of a play on words. Okay, so Abraham is now saying, I am claiming ownership to this well. Okay, verse 32, they made a covenant at Beersheba. Abimelech and Philcol, the commander of his army, arose, returned to the land of the Philistines. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba, and there he called on the name of the everlasting God, and Abraham sojourned in the land of the Philistines many days. Okay, so takes this well, and then what does he do? Verse 33. He plants a tree. Now, why would Moses care to mention that detail to us? This is one of those things, and I'm going to give you a bit of insight here. This is where going to the land completely changed my understanding of this text. Why in the world would Moses say, and he planted a tree? Okay, means life, okay? Planting a tree in the desert, hard to do? Yeah, it means shade. Okay, let me tell you about this tree. You guys know anything about tamarisk trees? Probably not, because I don't either. There's a tamarisk tree, okay? Here's another one. This is, I think, actually outside of Beersheba. I think this is where we're going to go. This is, that's Beersheba. Does that look like a good shade tree to you? No, okay? You remember the oaks of Mamre? You ever stood underneath an oak tree? They're gigantic. They're great shade trees. That, not so much, okay? Let me give you some stats just so you kind of understand this. This tree grows 1 foot in diameter every 500 years. So very, very slow growing. Okay, they excrete salt and other things, kind of a sappy substance and that sort of deal. So they can survive in the desert. It's a good tree to plant. But why would Abraham be planting a tree who grows so ridiculously slow he's never going to get to prosper from, like, how old is that tree? It's got to be old. It's got a thick what is it called? Trunk. Thank you. Goodness gracious. A thick trunk and there's shade, but Abraham is never going to get to enjoy that because he's going to be dead by the time that thing.
It's paralleling the promise because he's not going to be able to see the dealing of all the children that's going to be prosperity and all that.
Good. So what do you see in Abraham's faith by this? What is he saying? God's going to take care of him. Am I ever going to get to enjoy this tree? No. Who will? That are going to live in this land that God has given me. Has he seen any of the promises filled in totality that God's given him?
No.
No. But he's saying, I believe it, and I'm going to plant a tree that demonstrates that I believe this. So what's Abraham thinking about right now? Himself? No. He's thinking about the generations to come. Okay? This was for Christian Warren, who went to Israel last year. This was the most impactful lesson that he learned of all the sites we went. Okay? Why, for a guy in youth ministry, would this be such a big deal? For those of you that are taking care of little kids or older kids or whatever, why is this such a big deal? You'll have no idea what God does in that kid, right? Some snotty-nosed sixth grader that, you know, is making out in the back of the bus on a ski trip with whatever girl, right? And you're like, really, dude? Okay? It's just a nightmare kid, and you have no idea what your impact in their life is going to do. And it's not for 20 years later that that growth occurs. And you don't get to see it. You plant the seeds, and you hope and pray like crazy that God works it out, right? I had a coach in my life that was the biggest spiritual influence in my life. And when he was in my life, he had no idea what he was doing. I had no idea what he was doing. And it wasn't until years later when I became a Christian and I looked back and went, oh, I get it. I have a guy in my mind who I can picture and go, that's what a Christian's supposed to look like. Got it. But I didn't at the time have any idea. I didn't know. And he just labored faithfully, okay? That's a tamarisk tree, okay? Are you seeing Abraham's faith develop? He just got spanked again by Abimelech, is called to live rightly, And I think after this, the second time, he said, you know what? I need to live for the promise. God has given me my son. I'm now looking future. He is taking care of me. And you sense a different faith in Abraham. He's been through a lot. He's failed a couple tests. He's done well on a few. But at the end of the day, he's thinking about what God wants. Okay, so he sojourns in the land, verse 34, of the Philistines for many days. He stays there, has a good relationship, lives in Beersheba and these other towns and cities that he would have been living in and out of, and is planting trees and thinking of the future. Okay, so fascinating picture, okay, especially given what's coming in chapter 22. All right, you guys with me? All right, now, here is the eighth and final test of Abraham's life, okay, and it is the biggest that he has been called to do, and really, everything that's led up to this in his life was for this, okay? 22:1, let's pick up there.
After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah,
mm-hmm.
and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I shall tell you.
All right, so 22, God says to Abraham, let's go. I'm going to test you, okay? That's probably the best translation. There's some other ones, but God is basically saying, man, we're going to put your talk and your walk together, and we're going to see if you believe what you say you believe, that you really trust me when everything is out of your control, okay? Verse 2, what is the request from God?
Offer his son as a burnt offering.
Yep. Okay, so you're going to offer your kid, which kid?
Your only son.
Your only son. God clarifies, like Ishmael doesn't even live there with them anymore, right? He's in the desert in Paran with his Egyptian wife and mother, okay, living at home, right? That's Ishmael. But God clarifies, your son, your only son, the one that I recognize, okay, there is no backup plan, Abe, and you're going to put him on an altar as a burnt offering.
Isn't this before the sacrificial system?
Mm-hmm.
So this must have been really
bizarre. Yep. Yeah, we haven't seen all the sacrifices instituted in Leviticus. We've seen pictures of that in Abraham's life, of animals being cut in two. We saw it obviously in Genesis with one animal's blood being propitiation for another person. So the concept may have been there. Certainly within pagan culture, this probably was not abnormal for sacrifices to occur. We'll see that with some of the gods that live around the Israelites, that was normal. But this was not normative for God, okay? And certainly not human sacrifice, okay? Not at all. That's going to be forbidden in the law, okay? So this is an odd request on every level, okay? How are you feeling right now if you're Abraham? This isn't a small dream, right? This is... what is God doing, right? I've spent 25 years of my life, my whole life, I have reorged in order for this thing to come true, and now God is ripping it from me. Like, really, Lord? I moved out of Ur 25 years ago. Now we're here. I'm walking with you. You finally fulfilled your promise. It took you 25 years to get there, and then in an instant, you're calling to take that thing away, okay? There is no greater ask of Abraham, okay? Test 8 is really, he's asking for Abraham's life. He's asking for worship, whatever you want to call it. But there's nothing else that would have been more valuable to Abraham than Isaac, right? If he doesn't have Isaac, the promise is dead. And God's been very clear about that. Abraham gets that at this point. So this is a big deal, okay? I want you to notice Abraham's response, verse 3. Keep going.
So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place which God had told them.
So what's he do? He goes. Okay, so he's living in Beersheba, okay? And he's going to go to Mount Moriah, okay? So Beersheba, again, down south, okay? I want to show you that map, okay? So down south, where my head is, down yonder, no, right here, okay? And he's going to go up to Jerusalem or Mount Moriah, okay? So this is going to be a very, very important place historically, and it's going to start with Abraham, okay? So current location of the Temple Mount, where the temple is built today in Jerusalem, It is a stone's throw and possibly, some people believe, on the Temple Mount. Okay, so it is a mountain in Jerusalem called Mount Moriah. Okay, possibly even where some people believe where the Holy of Holies is within the temple, the holiest part of the temple, that Mount Moriah would have been exactly where the Ark of the Covenant stands or would have stood today. Okay, so pretty cool picture, and we'll unpack that more as we get through history. Yes, somewhere outside of the city. Okay, we'll see a couple spots when we go to Israel as to where they think that could have occurred. We don't know the exact location, but we knew that it's outside of the city, so it's not in this area. But it would have been this place, and Golgotha would have been within eyesight of each other. You would be able to see it. Okay, so this site has a lot of significance. Okay, so it's not by accident that God says go to Mount Moriah. Okay. It's important historically, and we'll see that as it fast forwards, okay? So God says, you're going to go here. You're going to sacrifice your son, okay? It takes them 3 days to get there, which is, quite frankly, a pretty long journey. It probably wouldn't have necessarily needed to take that long, but they do. So for whatever reason, it's a three-day journey, okay? So he takes with him now his servants, his son, wood. I mean, he's full-on ready to do this, right? Verse 5, okay, they get to the place where they're going to go, and I want you to notice Abraham's commentary. Read that.
Then Abraham said to his young man, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over and worship and come to you again.
Okay. What are you reading out of, Ben? What version?
Oh, ESV.
Somebody read NAS. Say verse 5. I and the lad will go over, and who's returning? We. Both. Talk to me.
He just has faith that God's going to be bigger and bring Isaac back with him no matter what happens.
Yeah, I have no idea how this is going to go down, but God's going to bring Abraham back. Have we seen resurrection from the dead yet?
Isaac, though.
Well, but God, Abraham somewhere in his brain has this idea that God will figure this out, okay? Insider trading information, turn to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17 through 19. Here is the author of Hebrews' commentary on what he thinks, Abraham thinks. Okay, Hebrews 11, the Hall of Faith. 17 through 11, somebody read that. Yeah, I'm sorry, 17 through 19. Chapter 11, 17 through 19. You need to live in my head. Don't worry about what comes out of my mouth.
By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was redeemed. In the act of offering up his only son, whom it was said, to Isaac shouted the offspring to me. He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, in which figuratively speaking, he did not receive him.
Are you kidding me? Have you seen just the growth in Abraham's faith? I mean, here's a guy that a couple chapters ago was lying to save his rear end and saying, Sarah, say that you're my sister. And here's a guy that says, I'll put my kid on an altar because God, I believe that you're able to raise people from the dead. And if you test my faith that far, I will kill my son on this altar if that's what it takes, because I believe that you're able to do beyond what I can even ask or imagine. Is that not insane? He's never seen this, okay? And we've seen it. I wouldn't do it. Right? I know that he can, but I'm not gonna. I'm not gonna put God in that situation, right? Can you imagine being asked to put your child on an altar, right? I can't fathom anything more asked of me, right? I would in a heartbeat take my own life. Yeah.
This promise is going to be fulfilled because God's the one who walked through.
Yep. And yeah. It took him a while to get that from his head to his heart, but he believes that, and to his fullest extent right now. And that's what God's doing. Abraham, do you really believe this? Are you willing to go as far as I ask you to go to demonstrate that your faith and your works match up, okay? It's funny, this part of the story is just, it's painfully slow. They're walking. It's a 3-day journey. Guys, stay here. We're going to return. Like, Moses just tells the story in a very dramatic fashion, okay? Back to Genesis. Verse 6, I'm going to keep going there.
And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together.
He's like, yikes, like that's just so awkward. What's Isaac saying? We'll see in a second. But I mean, can you imagine that conversation as the two of them are now walking alone, right? Just the knife, we got wood. They're going to talk about offering. So Isaac has enough insight at this point to understand that he knows what an offering is. By the way, Isaac's probably, he's a sixth grader, okay? He's intelligent. He knows what's going on. This is not some 2-year-old kid. This is a 13-year-old young man who is very cognitive of what's going on right now, okay? And you'll see in his comment, verse 7, that he's pretty clear on what's going on. Read that.
Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?
So he knows where they're going. He knows what they're going to do. He's carrying the wood on his back, which again is very symbolic. The father's only son with the wood on his back. Okay, there's a really cool picture of Christ in this. Okay, and he says, hey, I see we have everything, but we're missing the lamb. Okay, watch Abraham's response.
Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son.
Okay, so you see this faith in Abraham of God will provide, okay? And right now that provision is you. And if that's what God's calling me to do, like, can you imagine just the relationship between these two, okay? So the two of them walked on in verse 8 together. So they are alone, walking and having this conversation. So Isaac asks, God's going to provide. And then you just imagine this walk was just silent, right? As the two of them walk up out Mount Moriah, okay, this is not an easy little hike. They're having to, again, walk up to Mount Moriah because it's all on top of a mountain, okay? When they came to the place which God had told them, verse 9, Abraham built the altar there, arranged the wood, bound his son Isaac, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. I mean, he is gone to the full extent. Lays his son there, okay? He binds him, but do you see any outcry from Isaac?
I want to know what Isaac's response is. Like, I can't imagine him just being like, okay, Dad, sacrifice me. Like, I don't know.
I have no idea.
He doesn't give us, you know, the text doesn't say, but yeah. I can't imagine Isaac was just like, yeah, go for it, Dad. Like,
It's hard to say. He binds him as they would. That's normative of a sacrifice. You bind it to the horns of the altar. But there's no pushback from Isaac. Can you imagine? I had to go to the ER with Madison when she was 2. And she had, we were out and a couple was babysitting and they were wrestling and goofing off. And she smacked her eye on the coffee table right at the end. And just blew open, right? So she's got, like, over her eye, a big old gash. We come home and look at it, and it's like, yeah, it needs stitches. So we've got to go to the ER and get her stitched up. So we take her to Children's. It's like a Sunday afternoon. Like, everyone's gone except for, like, you know, newbie doctor and whatever. And it was just like, yeah. Okay, so not some children's commentary. But that day, it just happened to be a bad day when we went. And they were understaffed, and it was just an interesting day. Everybody wanted to go home, okay? So we get there, and like, yeah, we're going to need to stitch her up. So Madison is fighting, and she's frustrated and scared. And we can imagine it's a 2-year-old. You don't know what's going on. There's a lot of pain, and there's blood, and she's wigging out. So we go in there, and the first thing they have to do, obviously, is, you know, shoot her full of Novocaine. So they get out this needle, and she's wigging out. So I'm having to restrain my kid because there's not enough staff to, you know, hold her down. So they're like, okay. So literally, she's on the gurney, and I'm, like, on top of her, like, face-to-face holding her. And she's just freaking out. I can't hold her down. So they're like, hey, we can't do this. I'm like, okay. So they now go get the papoose. Have you guys seen this thing? It's a nice way to say straight jacket. They put you in it, and it takes your arms like this, and they tie around your back, OK? okay? So you're stuck, literally, just flailing about, right? And I'm laying on top of her, so she's still struggling, and they're trying to shoot her up with whatever they're putting in her, Novocaine, and she's screaming at me, "Daddy, you're hurting me. Daddy, you're hurting me. Daddy, why are you doing this to me?" And I'm literally, I'm over her crying, and I'm trying to help her understand, this is good for you. This is the best thing for you. You don't get it. Right now, all you can feel is the pain and the fear of the moment, but when it's over, this will be better. And this is my two-year-old who I know, we're going to get up, she's going to get a couple stitches, and she's going to walk out of here. It's not that big a deal. But for her, it was just traumatic. Can you imagine Abraham with that situation, binding his son and saying, I've got to go all the way. I've got to kill him. And that's what God's going to ask me to do. And I hope, I believe that God's able to bring this kid back from the dead. But that's, at this point, that's what his faith is. Like, this guy has come a long way from, you know, going to Egypt and trying to figure out ways around the will of God. He is full on in it. Okay, so that's the picture. So in the midst of that, Abraham stretches out, verse 10, his hand and took the knife to slay his son. So literally, he now has the knife in his hand. He's about to kill his son. Look who shows up, verse 11, our old friend.
But the angel of the Lord called him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am."
By the way, whenever you see a name repeated, Abraham, Abraham, okay? There's obviously some urgency in the moment, so that would have been a piece of it. But it's also a term of endearment. Okay, it's a term that says, I know you. It means intimacy. It's like when I call my wife babe, okay? None of you can call my wife that. I can. Or you can, and you can see what happens, okay? But you'll only do it once, I assure you, okay? So that's the idea. I know you, Abraham, Abraham. Okay, there's a sense of endearment between these two. And he said, here I am. Okay, and here's the request now of the angel, verse 12.
He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son from me.
So what does that mean? What is God saying in verse 12? Was he not sure where the faith of Abraham was?
No, it's not that he didn't know. It's...
What is he making Abraham do with his faith? Yeah, you're going to have to flesh this out, and you're going to have to put it into action, okay? This is the type of text that James would love, right? The book of James. Look, faith without works is dead. It's useless. I don't care what you say you believe, okay? That's meaningless to me. Show me your faith. And until you can show me what you believe, your faith is meaningless. Now, Paul would say, is that faith good enough to save you? Absolutely. Do you have to demonstrate works in order to be saved? No, right? By faith alone, in Christ alone, period. But your faith can only be demonstrated by your works. The reality is, in this room, none of us know if anyone in this room is saved. You cannot know. I can say it. I can talk about it. You can tell me your story. I can read your testimonies as I did when you guys applied. I don't know. The only way that I can see evidence of what's happening internally is through your external actions, right? That's what this is for Abraham. Now, God knows because he can see hearts. But I think with Abraham, he's calling him to flesh out all that you believe. Are you willing to do with your faith all that you say that you believe about it? Which means, if you really believe me, then you believe I'm sovereign. And I can ask you to take the life of your son, the most precious thing in your life, both for now and for eternity, and ask you to kill him. Will you do that? Do you believe that much? And Abraham says, absolutely, I'm willing to. And God had obviously never intended for him to do that, but That's what he calls him to do, okay? So God stops, okay? Says, don't do this, okay? This is the angel of the Lord, the theophany, the pre-incarnate Christ. And then in 13, watch what shows up.
And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram, caught in a thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son.
All right, so God now, again, just the cool picture. God provides a substitutionary atonement. He provides another in the place of Isaac to die, a ram. The ram will be part of the Levitical sacrifice in future. And they slay this animal, okay? And watch what they call this place now, 14.
So Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide.
The Lord will provide, Mount Moriah. Okay, so Mount Moriah, which is either well, it's at least an eye shot of where Christ is going to be crucified years later. The Lord will provide. Jehovah Jireh or Yahweh Jireh, okay? The Lord will see to it, or the Lord will provide is what that means, okay? The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time and said, verse 16, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you. I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of heaven. Okay, again, a reiterating of the Abrahamic covenant. You're going to be blessed because you've done this, because you truly believe. Verse 18, in your seed, all the nations will be blessed. You've obeyed my voice. Verse 19, Abraham returns with his young man. They arose, went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived in Beersheba. Okay, fascinating picture. You know, these men are down here, and exactly what Abraham said happened. They have no idea what happened up the hill. We're going to go up. We're going to worship, and we're going to return. And here they come, right back down the hill. Abraham and Isaac go up. Abraham and Isaac come down. Okay, so beautiful picture. Okay, so this was now the greatest test of Abraham's life. Are you willing to lay it down, okay, for me and do whatever I ask you to do, as crazy as it may sound? Okay, and he passes with flying colors. Okay, he gets word now in verse 20 that Milcah had borne children to Nahor, his brother. Okay, so now we got some family. 21, interesting names for his nephews. Read that.
Who's firstborn?
Or Uz and Buzz. Okay, so like, man, don't those look like two guys that live in Arkansas that hunt like all day long? My name's Uz. This is my brother Buzz. Right? We shoot stuff. Just whatever. Uz and Buzz. Okay, so. This is part of Abraham's family, so welcome. They even have dysfunctional relatives, right? These are the guys that live in Arkansas right here. They come for Christmas once a year and can't wait until they leave. Yep.
Every family has rednecks in it.
Yep. This is where it started, right here. The beginning of the rednecks right here. So, I got a couple guys in my life group that are just redneck as the day is long. They are wonderful, but they are funny. So, anyway, good dudes. Okay. Notice who else shows up in 22. We get Hesed and Hazo. 23, Bethuel became the father of Rebecca. Who is Rebecca? Fast forward the story. Who's this going to be?
Wife.
Isaac's wife. Okay, so we see her born. Okay, and then a few more mentioned in 24. Okay, 23 now. Cool chapter. Okay, this is cool. Sarah's now going to die, but the picture of what's going to happen here is pretty neat, okay? 23:1, read that. Not that I'm excited that Sarah dies. Madison asked my oldest, she's now 11, okay? So that was a long time ago when we moved here. But she asked me every year, she's like, she always asks me kind of where we're at in the story, and she'll say, well, has Abraham died yet, or this, that, and the other thing? And I'm like, no, or I'll tell her where we're at. And I'm like, it's so weird, they die every year, and every year I hope they don't, but they do. So anyway, here we go again. It still hasn't changed. She's going to die. 23, keep going. 23:1.
Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went into mourn for Sarah and
her. Okay, Kiriath Arba. Okay, so this is Hebron right here. Kiriath Arba is the same town. When it got named what is interesting. It's Hebron today. Okay, but this is going to be where she dies. Okay, again, Jerusalem is right here, so it's kind of due. Yeah, south, southwest of Jerusalem, okay? So location's not super important other than you need to know that it's in the land, okay? So she dies in the land of Canaan, okay, which is going to be important, okay? So he goes to mourn and weep for her, obviously, which is customary. Verse 3, Abraham rose from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heath, okay? Heath would have been the Hittites, okay? So these are the group of people that live outside the land, but because of trade or whatever reason, they now live in Hebron. They are the squatters of the day, if you will, and they own the rights to everything in the land. Okay, so he's going to go have a conversation with these guys. Okay, we've never seen this before. Here's what he says, verse 4.
I'm a sojourner and foreigner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight.
Okay, so Abraham lives in Beersheba right now, right? Down south, edge of the desert, okay? Sarah dies here in the middle of the promised land. So he comes to the sons of Heath, the Hittites, and says what? What does he want? Yeah. Okay, so he says, give me a burial site, okay? So here's their answer, verse 5.
They answered Abraham, hear us, my lord. You are a prince of God among us. Bury your dead in the choices of our our tombs. None of us will withhold from you this tomb to hinder you from burying your dead.
All right, so they say, man, you're legendary around this area. We know you. Take whatever you want. Bury your, we're not going to refuse anything. Pick your cave, okay? Now, this is a bit of a, it's a sales tactic on their part, okay? So, pick whatever you want, Abraham. Okay, keep going.
Abraham rose and bowed to the Hittites, the people of the land, and he said to them, if you are willing that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat for me Ekron, the son of Zohar.
Okay, so he's got a guy in mind who he knows that owns a cave within this area, and he says, I want this dude's cave, so go get him, okay? So I want, verse 9, that he may give me the cave at Machpelah, okay, which he owns, which is at the end of his field, for the full price, let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site, okay? So he says, go get this dude, go get Ephron. I want his cave at the end of his field in Machpelah, and what am I going to do? Am I going to take it? No. What am I going to do? I'm paying retail, okay? I'm going to pay full price. I want to own this. We've never seen this with Abraham, right? He's never bought any land. He's just, he's been a sojourner. He just lives in the land and he bounces around and he digs wells and whatever, but he's never been interested in saying, look, I need the title. I need the deed, right? I need the mineral rights. I live here. This is the land that God's given me, but he hasn't purchased anything, okay? This one's different. He says, I'm going to pay for it, okay? And you'll notice here, he's in the presence of everyone else, and he says, I want everyone to witness this. All the elders of the city, we're going to purchase this, and it's going to be mine, okay? Verse 10, keep going.
Now Ephron was sitting among the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites of all who went in at the gate of his city. No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the sight of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead.
Okay, so he says the same thing that the group said earlier, which is, dude, take the cave. It's yours to take. Take it, okay? Now, again, that's not what he means, okay? This is a bargaining tool. And he's saying, it's like when you have, I don't know, you have like one concert ticket and there's two people that can go and you're saying, hey, do you want to go? Are you sure you don't want it? You're not really offering it, but you're offering it because it's the right thing to do or whatever, but you're hoping to say, no, I really want to take this. They're expecting to get paid for this cave, and I'll show you why in a second, okay? So he says, hey, take it, and Abraham bows before them. They're being polite and respectful of one another. Verse 13, keep going.
And he said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, but if you will hear me, I give the price of the field. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead there.
Okay, so he says, no, name your price, okay? And then here's his price, verse 15.
Answered Abraham, my lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between you and me? Bury your dead.
Okay, so he names a price, 400 shekels, which means nothing to us, okay? This is akin to someone saying, hey, I got a 1982 used Honda Civic that you guys want to buy, okay? Let's call it 30 grand even. Like, I'm sorry? You know, that's probably worth 800 bucks. Yeah, but what's 30 grand between you and me? Like, he's getting ripped off so ridiculously that it's hard to even paint a picture, okay? Jeremiah, in the book of Jeremiah, is going to pay 17 shekels for an entire field, okay? Abraham is about to pay 400 shekels for a cave in a field, okay? David pays 50 shekels for threshing floor and oxen later on, in the book of 2 Samuel, okay? 400. Now, we don't know inflation and rates and all that other stuff that was going on, but it seems like, Machpelah, by the way, means double price, okay? It seems like Abraham is getting hosed big time in this deal, okay? So he names his price and he says, you know, yeah, I'm going to charge you an outrageous amount because I know you've got the means and you can pay for it. Yeah, it's worth whatever you're going to pay for it. So how bad do you want the 182 Honda Civic in town? I have the only one, 30 grand. Okay, so.
So he's not, what if it's like a reverse of that? He's making the price so high, so he just takes it instead of actually
paying it. Yeah, I don't think so. I think this was the ploy the whole time. Man, he's a business guy. He's trying to be respectful of Abraham, but he wants to get paid. He's not giving away land to some guy that doesn't.
Yeah.
Maybe he doesn't, okay? Watch what he does, verse 16.
Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weights current among the merchants.
He doesn't even make a counteroffer. Okay, 400 shekels. There you go. Done. You're all clear on that? My field. I just bought it. Elders, Hittites, we good? I just bought this. It's my field. Okay? Why is that such a big deal to Abraham? Why is he so akin to say, I am buying this cave in the promised land to bury my wife?
Because God promised him land.
This is a tamarisk tree all over again. I am burying my wife in the land of the promise. This is the only piece of land that is mine that I own. Where would he normally go to bury his wife? Think about this.
Probably somewhere in Beersheba.
Maybe. So where would they go? Where's Sarah's family? Yeah, that's where they're from, right? And we're going to see, they're going to make that trek again, okay, because they've got family out that way. Abraham says no, okay? It's like a woman getting married, right? She goes off to college in some town, but is from another town and getting married in that college town. You're like, you wouldn't do that. You would go home and get married where all your friends and your family and your relatives are. That's normative, right? To go get buried outside of that, and you're basically saying that's we're done with that. That's old chapter in our life, okay? Abraham is making a very significant statement about his faith and what he believes God's going to do. I am going to bury my wife, and then where is he going to get buried, obviously? Next to her, in the cave of Machpelah. So he's making a statement, okay? So very cool on Abraham's part that he would say, I'm going to bury my wife here and then my ancestors after that, okay? So he buys the field, 17, keep going there. Okay, now notice what all Abraham just ended up purchasing. What did he want?
He wanted the cave.
The cave in the field, right? What did he just buy?
The trees.
The trees, which means they're in the field. He's bought the field and the cave. You see what? He was trying to unload all of this. Apparently, Ephron didn't want all that. So Abraham says, hey, I just want to buy the cave. And he says, no, you're going to buy everything. Cave's not for sale. You want the whole plot of land? You can pay for all of it, okay? So he gets more than he wanted, which is why I think he paid for the price that he did. But he's like, I'm not selling you the cave, okay? You know, he sells them everything. So there was probably some responsibilities or whatever that he didn't want that he was willing to unload on Abraham, and he can deal with the mess of it, okay? So he got the trees, the field, the cave, and everything in it, all right? Abraham got it as a possession in the presence of the sons of Heath before all who went in and out of the city, the gate of the city. So where do they make this deal? 18? Out of the what? The gate. Okay. Who's at the gate? Okay. The important people. Okay. So this was an official transaction, and that's where it was made because the gate of the city is where that went down. Okay. Keep going to 19 and 20. We'll finish this chapter. Okay, so buries her in the land of Canaan. Keep going.
So the field and the cave were deeded to Abraham by the Hittites as a burial site.
All right, so we have now seen the patriarch die, or the matriarch rather, of all of Israel. Okay, she's buried in the land. Okay, we can't go there. It's still in Hebron today. Obviously, that place hasn't moved. It's Palestinian occupied, so we can't go there, but you'll see. A big sign when we go through Azekah, when we go see the David and Goliath battlefield, there's a big sign that says Caves of Machpelah, okay? That way. We can't go. But, so they found the place, they know where it is, they know where they were buried, okay? So that is it, all right? So we will stop there and pick up on next Friday on chapter 24, cool deal. Rick is going to come in on Thursday and teach you now, finally, now that we're through Abraham, Abraham's history. He's going to walk you through Sumer and where he was from and how that impacts the text. So now that you've read it and seen it and heard it, I think all this will kind of even come to more light as you're is you're hearing about Abraham's background and what he would have learned in the culture that he's from. All right? So I will see you guys next Friday. You'll get Rick on Thursday. Have a lovely weekend. Until next time, peace to you.